My name is Jean Balint. I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, and I will be serving as today's moderator and host for our session, which is a Clue and Internet seminar, which has been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And today's session is a NARPRM's Present seminar, part of a multi-seminar series that's been hosted on Clue-In for the past few weeks and will continue on for the next few weeks. Today's session is going to focus on ARRs for the protection of ecological and historical resources. So if you're joining us on the phone lines, welcome. We do ask, if you haven't done so already, to go ahead and mute your telephone lines. You can use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your phone lines. This is a reminder for everyone who's joining us today. Clue and Internet seminars will operate very closely to conference calls. So each individual participant is expected to have a copy of the materials in front of them. If you haven't done so already, you'll want to be sure to either download or print or open up in a web browser window a copy of today's presentation materials. If you don't have that already in front of you, in one of the reminder emails or when you actually signed up, you would have been given a confirmation message that would have directed you to today's seminar homepage. From that seminar homepage, you can either click the button that says Go to Seminar, which will load the slides in a web browser window for you, or you can follow links that appear at the bottom of that very same page to download the slides as either PowerPoint or PDF. So again, you want to be sure to have a copy of today's presentation materials open in front of you. I'm going to ask everyone to turn the page or move along to slide number 2. If you have a copy in front of you, simply turn the page or click the Enter button to move ahead. If you're looking at the slides through a web browser window, though, you'll see a series of numbered links that appear on the left-hand side. You can use those numbered links to jump over to the correct slide, and again, we're on slide number 2. Or you can use the icons that appear at the top of your slides. You'll see a series of orange circles or icons. If you see one with a single arrow pointing to the right, it will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. So again, you can use those to move back and forth through the materials. This is a reminder, if you're on the phone lines, we do ask to mute your phone lines. If you have a mute button, go ahead and press the mute button. You can also use our phone commands, which is *6 to mute. We're going to hold the questions until the end of the presentation materials today, and at that point, we'll invite everyone to unmute and ask questions if they like. But until then, we do ask you keep yourself on mute. Do not put the call on hold. Sometimes there are commercials or music that could be disruptive to us. So if you need to, you can certainly hang up and dial back into the phone line at any time. There won't be any disruption or announcement. So just be sure to keep yourself on mute and don't put the call on hold. Again, we're going to hold questions until the end of the presentation today. Those of you on the phone lines will be, or pardon me, not at the end, there will be sections indicating when you can take questions. And at that point in time, we'll provide reminders of how you can unmute your phone lines and actually ask the questions out loud. Those of you who are streaming the audio online won't have a chance to verbally ask the questions, but you can actually type up questions or comments electronically at any point in time. And when we get to the appropriate breaks or Q&A, I will read those out loud on your behalf. You'll want to look for a button that appears on the top of your slides that has a question mark in it. Make sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled so that when you click that question mark, a new window will open up and you can actually type up your comment or question. Again, you can do that at any point in time. We just simply will hold those questions until we get to the appropriate breaks for question and answer, and at that time I'll read them out loud so that we can get a response from our speakers. If you're having any technical difficulties, you can also use that very same question mark icon to report them. Just be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached so that our support staff can give you a call to help troubleshoot whatever your issues are. A final reminder for everyone today, today's session is being recorded and it will be archived. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to get the recordings ready. Everyone who signed up for today's session will automatically receive a reminder as soon as that recording session is available. Alternatively, you can simply go to clueinn.org/training and follow the links to the archive seminars where you can look at the over 360 seminars we have available for free download and replay right now. I believe that is the end of the official reminders that I have for everyone before we kick things off. It sounds like the phone lines are nice and quiet, so I thank you in advance for muting your lines. It looks like we have over 160 people who have actually checked in for today's session, so I'd like to welcome you from all across the U.S. and actually a few international participants. And with that, I'm going to direct everyone to move along to slide number 3, which is the official start of today's training materials. And at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Bruce Pluta from US EPA Region 3. Bruce, are you ready?
And with that, trying to catch my breath here, I will say that while we will take questions at the end, we have a couple of pause points that we'll identify within the presentation to enable folks to answer, to ask some questions, and we'll do our best. I am Bruce Pluta. I'm with the EPA Regions 3 Biological Technical Assistance Group. Joining me is Simeon Hahn, who is with NOAA, who is a member of this group. To give you a little bit of a background on this, and you should be on slide 3 right now. I believe Gene mentioned that. A little bit of background on this presentation. The webinar is based on the presentation that was given at last year's NARPM session of the same name. For those of you that may not be aware, NARPM is the National Association of Remedial Project Managers for EPA, and they have an annual meeting. And within the meeting, there are a number of sessions. Last year, Simeon had suggested having a session specifically dealing with natural resource, ecologically based ARRs, and trying to help bring the issues to the forefront, specifically with the idea of trying to get people to think about these things a little bit earlier on. Now, before I go into any detail, I should say that the original presentation slides for this program can be found on the NARPM website. And you will see the URL for that on the bottom of slide 3. The original session was scheduled to go a lot longer than what we have today, so I will not be going over every slide in detail by any stretch of the imagination. Plus, we had a pretty diverse crowd presenting those, doing the different presentations. If you go to slide 4, you'll see the number of individuals that were presenting at our session. The most important ones, to a certain degree in my mind, that you should note are two gentlemen from the Office of Regional Council, one at headquarters and one in Region 4. I say they're the most important because I think, as you will see in a number of these slides, it is very heavy on the regulations and details pertaining to those regulations. I want to thank those folks, first of all, for, the information that they have in these slides, and all these slides are available. And these individuals are infinitely more knowledgeable on the specifics of the information contained within their slides than I definitely am. So I think when it comes down to if you have specific questions, we'll do our best, but there are references and resources included within the presentations that you can go to. The primary purpose and the focus of the session is to be able to inform people about the basic ecologically related ARRs, how to identify them, the need to identify them early, as well as all ARRs to identify as early as possible. And finally, where we can try to give you some insight into how you can more easily meet the ARRs so you can minimize any impacts that they may in fact have on your project. So that's really the purpose of this. We're not going to go in not an ARRs course per se. It's just to try giving you a little bit better appreciation, maybe have you recognize a few more ARRs than you may have been familiar with before. So with that, if you could turn to slide 5. And we'll go over some of the basics of the ARRs. And I use basics pretty lightly because in my mind, a lot of the stuff when it comes down to ARRs and understanding them and how, you know, what's applicable, what's relevant, and all that fun stuff, it's anything but basic sometimes. No matter how long you've been in the field, I think you hear someone come at it from a little different perspective and you gain a little bit more insight than you may have had before. So with that, if you would go to slide 6. And this is, a very basic tenet of CERCLA when it comes down to cleanup. And that's kind of where things go. We'll begin with essentially the end part of CERCLA, cleaning up the sites. But ultimately, the remedial actions have to be protective of human health and the environment, and they shall attain ARRs. So that really boils down to why the whole discussion of ARRs is so important. And that's when we start going into, you know, right from the definition, we look into, you know, what is applicable. Is it applicable to a specific substance, you know, a pollutant or a contaminant, or is it relative and appropriate regarding the circumstances of the release? And we'll go into that in a little bit more detail now. If you want more information on the degree of cleanup and talking about some of the legislation and promulgated standards and all that kind of fun stuff, you can turn to slide 7, and that will give you a little bit more detail than what I will go into now, but obviously there's a number of citations there that you can check out for more information. Another thing that's important to note that seems to come up in turning to slide 8, often there's a lot of questions about how to waive ARRs. It's kind of interesting. It seems like in many cases there's more discussion about how to waive ARRs than achieving them sometimes. But it's important to note that the circumstances where you can waive ARRs and how to do that are pretty specific and they're pretty limited. So it's important to keep that in mind. Going to slide 9. For remedial actions, it's very important that ARRs are identified early in the entire process. We had noted in a couple of places that, you know, and you'll see it throughout, that, you know, they need to be identified as early as and as part of the SS. But the more I go over this stuff, I think the more impresses upon me that even in the FS, it's really too late in some cases, that it's important to take care of the ARRs, identify these right from the start. And the importance of compliance with the ARRs, you know, it's specified within the NCP that, you know, the two of the threshold requirements, the first one is protection of human health and the environment, and the second is compliance with the ARRs. And it's important to note that when it comes to preparing your rod, you need to specify all of the federal and state ARRs that are applicable and that the remedy will attain or, in some cases, again, won't meet and there's a waiver. Now, the importance of including that in the rod, again, that will carry through the rest of the remedial process. But, again, if you're going to be identifying an ARR in the rod, obviously you need to know the breadth of that particular ARR as early as possible. Turning to slide 10. Now, the purpose of the ARRs and why they're important. EPA uses standards from other environmental laws to help select cleanup levels and to design the responses. And that really comes down to the key. Compliance with the ARRs, again, it often determines what the cleanup standard for a site is going to be or how the remedial approach or what the remedial approach is going to be taken. It'll influence that remedial approach. A good example of that is, for example, operating within a wetland. If you know that you have to do something within a wetland, that's going to impact the approach that you have to take because you know you're going to have to do certain actions to mitigate your impacts. As I'm sure most of you know, there are three categories of ARRs, chemical, location, and action-specific ones. Moving on to slide 11. There's a couple of items that are important to note here on this slide, and that's primarily the very first item, and that's that all on-site actions have to comply with the substantive aspects of the AORs. And that's really key. I mean, and when it comes down to specifying sections of the of a particular regulation that is applicable in the ROD, that's where a lot of this comes in. The other thing I think that this is going to be the recurring concept. You're going to hear it numerous times throughout this presentation, and that's the importance of consulting with other agencies throughout the process. It's most particularly important for location-specific AORs because many of those location-specific AORs directly impact other agencies. Moving on to slide 12. Obviously, this slide is presenting some of the basic definitions here. And again, it's important to note that a requirement is going to be applicable if the specific terms directly address the circumstances or specifically address the hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant or other circumstance found at the CERCLA site. Again, it's a very specific, direct relationship there. And I guess, you know, in my notes, when I see applicable, my highlight goes to the specific terms or jurisdictional requirements. On to slide 13. A regulation, on the other hand, is going to be or can be relevant and appropriate if it addresses the problems or situations that are sufficiently similar to those at the site, and their use is well suited to the site. So you don't necessarily have that direct, you know, here's a number, it definitely applies to the site. It's not a, you know, a one-to-one direct linkage, but it's talking about, again, situations, problems that are similar to those at the site, and to be able to take those, it makes sense that it relates to the site. Slide 14, chemical-specific AORs. I think this is the group of AORs that most people immediately think of when they think of an AOR. Give you an example. When polling different risk assessors in preparing for this presentation last year, kind of like a Jeopardy poll. 9 out of 10 readers say the vast majority of folks, when you ask them about AORs that they run into, inevitably it comes down to things like ambient water quality criteria, state water quality criteria, development of site-specific water quality criteria, and those are the kind of things that are chemical-specific AORs. So those are pretty easy and, those are easy to identify when they're going to occur when it comes to developing site-specific AORs and that kind of thing. It may not necessarily be easy to do, but they are more easily to identify. And again, I had noted before, if you move into slide 15, one of the important things of AORs is their role in cleanup goals. In many cases, especially when it comes down to the chemical-specific AORs, they are directly used in many, many cases, if not most cases, as potential cleanup goals or as the actual cleanup goals when all is said and done. So the importance is pretty well evident, I think. Okay, moving to slide 16. Location-specific AORs. I think that when I think of ecologically based ARRs, and ones that are really applicable to ecological risk assessment and impacts on the environment, I tend to think of location-specific ARRs. And it could very well be that it's kind of the nature of, they often give us a lot of problems if they're not identified early on. And I guess at that point I'll point you to the very last bullet of slide 16. That again, it should be identified in the RI phase of the investigation. That it's important for lead and support agencies to identify potential ARRs that are related to location as early as possible, again, at least during the RI. And we're going to touch on this a little bit later on when I go over and talk about my perspective as a BTAG coordinator and how the BTAG can help folks identify ARRs. Suffice it to say, if you turn to slide 17, you might get a better handle on what I'm talking about as far as why I view location-specific ARRs as something that pops out more as ecologically driven. Because when you start talking about things like the Endangered Species Act, Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, clean water, Section 404, and wetlands, obviously those are the kind of things that pop out to an ecological risk assessor is starting to enter into, for lack of a better word, enter into my domain. Now, that's not to discount one of the key location-specific ARRs, and that's the National Historic Preservation Act. And we're going to touch on that a little bit today, but not go into a lot of detail. That is a subject that I don't know if I can do that sufficient justice. The original presentation really doesn't go into it in enough detail, I think, to do it good enough justice. This year's NARPM presentations, I think, are going to touch this whole aspect in a little bit more detail. So hopefully any kind of needs that are out there that folks on the line see in this, they're going to be able to get more information than they currently have as time goes on. So I feel obligated to note that just because I may not be getting into it too much doesn't mean I don't think it's important, because it definitely is. Slide 18 addresses or identifies action-specific ARRs. And I think, by and large, most of the things that we see that we think of as far as ecologically impacting and doesn't really go into the realm of action-specific ARRs. Now, as soon as I say that, I'm sure there will be a number of specific examples folks can give, but the bottom line is I don't think that tends to be as much of a driver from the ecological and historic perspective. Moving on to slide 19, the TBC category, I think that's one of the ones that has a tendency to be, for lack of a better word, most interesting. I think there's a lot more questions that arise, more flexibility, and there's the realm of being able to capture an awful lot under the TBCs. I think the bottom line is when you're identifying potential ARRs and TBCs, that obviously, and this is probably should be an underpinning, make sure you consult with the site attorney, with the RPM and the site attorneys with these things, because ultimately they're going to have the best sense of where they fall into. Specific examples of TBCs that you know, aside from the ones listed here, ones that fall into the ecological realm that we have seen have been things such as TMDLs. Now, I know that opinion varies from agency to agency, from region to region, probably from one cubicle to the next. But I still consider TMDLs generically, and you'll see why later, I think, as TBCs. Other things like Urban Water Initiative, in our region, the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Strategy, and there are others. It's these kind of things that I think fall into the TDC realm. Moving on to slide 30, slide 20. The next few slides are going to basically present info on the identification of ARRs. I think one thing that's important to note, again, is what you'll see throughout here is the emphasis on, go to the bottom line, identification early in the process. In this particular one, it's, you know, talking about scoping or identifying during the scoping phase of RIs. Moving on to slide 21, this gives you some examples of some basic questions to help identify ARRs. And if you look into the middle, again, right from the start, you look at things like, you know, where is the site located? Is it located within some of these sensitive areas that are going to be addressed by different regulations? And this kind of thing should be happening as an RI is being scoped out, so different phases of the work can get done in an appropriate time. Moving on to slide 22. What you'll often see is during the process, typically what we see is you'll get a laundry list of ARRs, of potential ARRs being identified as part of an SF, hopefully, maybe as part of a proposed plan or a ROD if it's running a little bit late. But the bottom line is you know, you'll get these very large lists that are going to have to be gone through by the RPM and by the attorney. And generally, those citations are pretty generic. Ultimately, what you're going to end up seeing, I think, is the most helpful citation list are the ones that are as specific as possible. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I know it's often difficult to do. And knowing the way that the lists are prepared for an FS, it lends itself to that laundry list. But I think to the degree, if you're preparing that initial list, the degree that you can be as specific as possible, as early as possible, you're going to help everybody out down the line. Moving to slide 23. I wanted to touch on the state ARRs very briefly, because I think where I have seen issues is knowing when a state regulation is an ARR. And they are specified here, but I think one thing that really kicks in that ends up being one of the discriminators or things that have to be really considered is to make sure that the requirement has been consistently applied by the state. And in a lot of cases, I think that's where some confusion ends up coming into the process. With that, and you can take a look, you know, as you get a chance, scroll through slide 24, gives a little bit more detail on those kind of limitations. Now, we're going to jump ahead here very shortly. Now, the next groups of slides go into the notification, communication, identification of AOR process, and there's a lot of good detailed information here. So I think, you know, if you get a chance, take a look through these. You know, I think the more you know about these, the better off you're going to be in terms of trying to identify and really get into it. When you get through, starting with slide 34, there's a lot of, there's a series of examples here that really give some good information and some good examples. Now, I have heard from RPMs and some attorneys that, you know, as good as this appears to be, the ones that are even better, that go into even more detailed descriptions as far as what piece of the specific cited regulation, you know, what element of that is really an ARR. Rather than citing an entire section of an act, you know, what piece of that really applies, and to really narrow it down to that level of detail. So you know, when you get to developing these lists, you know, again, make sure you consult with the RPMs and the attorneys to make sure you're giving the most applicable and relevant, sorry, the most helpful information that you can right up front. So we can skip to slide 39 now and cut into some take-home messages. And I'm sure you'll be surprised when you kick to the overall lesson learned here is, again, the need for early, prompt, and continuous communication on site information, update remedial alternatives, and refine ARRs. Again, the earlier you do it, the better off you're going to be. I think one other thing that is important to note here, and you'll see it in some of the details, is, you know, where necessary, make sure that you're consulting with the appropriate subject matter experts. It varies from region to region as far as what kind of internal support there might be and what those individuals are called and what groups they're in. But the bottom line is I think every region definitely internally has folks that can help within the different consulting firms. There's individuals that, you know who the subject matter experts are. You know where to turn. Within the states, the different federal groups, everybody's got these groups of people that, know specific things that they can really tap into. And one of the important things, for me as far as providing technical support to RPMs and even to attorneys is, I have that network of individuals that I know of outside of the agency that are familiar with the regulations that their organization is responsible for. So it's, trying to use this network as best you can to identify the applicable requirements as early as possible. We move on to slide 40, and we're going to go through these very quickly just so you see what they are. Slide 40 is giving the different references on ARRs. Slide 41 has a very good the screenshot from EPA's webpage that discusses ARRs, and there's some good information contained there. And that, that link is still a correct link. It's still working. Nothing's changed on that particular part of the website. And if it has, all you have to do is do a search on EPA Superfund ARRs, and it'll take you to this page. Slide 42 gives you information on fact sheets on ARRs. And if that's not enough, turning to slide 43, there's some more guidance on ARRs. Like I said, and what we've discussed for about 30 minutes, it's the tip of the iceberg. Again, the take-home message is to identify the ARRs early on, use the network that you can to identify them, and realize that it's, site situations change, and the identification process is going to evolve as a site develops quite often. So to give you a good example of how that kind of thing happens, let's turn to slide 44, and let's talk about a specific site that we are dealing with here in Region 3, and it kind of illustrates some of the points that that I've been talking about. The Copper Superfund site is located in Delaware. It's a former wood treater. Property contains over 100 acres of tidal wetland. It is currently in the remedial design stage. It was originally listed in 1990, and there was a record of decision signed in 2005. Now, I say it's now in the remedial design phase. One of the things that's kind of interesting is because of some of the ARR process and the way it developed, it's been stalled in the remedial design phase for a while because of things that have come to light in the consultation process necessary under National Historic Preservation Act. So some of the initial consultation, while some of the screening was done, more information has come to light, and the process has gotten even more developed and more complicated than ever was originally intended. If you should be on slide 45 right now. With the wetlands, some of the issues tied to the wetland, as I said, is about a third of the property includes tidal wetlands. Some of the wetlands were, in fact, filled as part of operations at the site over the historic time frame that the site was operating. Some of the remedial actions will, in fact, take place in wetlands. And as you know, wetlands that are going to be damaged or destroyed are going to need to be replaced, or appropriate mitigation measures are going to have to be taken. One of the things during the identification of endangered species, a state endangered plant was found outside. So at the moment, the plant is located outside where the actions are going to occur, so hopefully it's not going to become an issue. Now, I say a lot of what-ifs and hopefullys in there. The plant was originally identified during the RI process, but again, as time evolves, it's important to keep in mind that things change on a site. So things like endangered species consultation and when, you know, whether or not endangered species, for example, is going to be an AROR, it's important to keep in mind those consultations have a limited time frame, so it's important to do something like that every couple of years. In this particular case, while the identification was done early in the process, as part of the remedial design, the actual field survey took place again to identify where the plant was to make sure that there wasn't any additional movement of the plant that the that it hasn't spread and it wouldn't be in areas where the actions would occur. The other thing that's important to keep in mind for this particular site is what was envisioned during the RI phase of the project and what the footprint of the action would be. Obviously, those kind of things have a tendency to morph. So when it came down to the remedial design and how that was going to be implemented, that footprint changes. So while you an area may not have been impacted in the first place, as time goes on, it may in fact now be within the footprint of the action. One of the other issues that came up with the wetlands was the question of whether or not the wetlands were jurisdictional wetlands or not. During the RI and actually through the ROD itself, the understanding was that all of the wetlands that were going to be impacted were in fact jurisdictional wetlands. And it's something as simple as this, when the footprint expanded and it went into some other areas of wetlands, the question was raised whether or not these additional areas were in fact jurisdictional wetlands. So now we had, sitting at the table during the remedial design, we had EPA, we had the PRPs, we had NOAA, we had Fish and Wildlife, and we had the Corps of Engineers. Many of those folks, as you, I'm sure you realize, have a stake in wetlands and whether or not they're jurisdictional or not. The main issue being that both EPA and the Corps of Engineers had regulatory roles there, with the Corps having the initial role. So the original concept was that we would ask the Corps of Engineers wetlands group to take a look, make the determination. And as we went through the process, ultimately it was determined that since it is a CERCLA action and EPA ultimately has final sign-off on the regulatory side of things anyway, EPA can make the JD call. So, while it seems like a relatively simple thing, that process took some time to work out. And then when you talk about you know, getting someone in the field and working according to people's schedules, you know, the whole process probably tied into a couple of months on the overall schedule. Now, luckily, that was being done along with other things, but again, it shows you how something seemingly simple can have a significant time impact if it weren't integrated and addressed appropriately. Excuse me. Turning to slide 47. I apologize. The other, probably the most interesting aspect of this particular site was the historic preservation end of things. Now, preliminary cultural resource survey was completed as part of the RI process. Artifacts were identified. The area was identified as an area to be addressed. Historic Preservation Act was listed as a major AR in the proposed plan. But there, you know, as noted in the slide, there were some inadvertent admissions in the ROD. And the bottom line is we did go back, we did an ESD to clarify that it is in fact an AR. And the importance of that came through even more if you turn to slide 48. Additional work was done in this area, and it turns out that this site is considered the most significant prehistoric archaeological site in the state of Delaware. We've got tribal interest concerns with the artifacts. The state's really stoked. I mean, it's a good site. It's an interesting site. And currently we're going through the consultation process. And this is a good example of how things, you know, unanticipated delays can occur. Now, at this particular point in time, we're still in the consultation process. It started about a year and a half ago. And essentially, the RRD is kind of on hold, waiting for the outcome of this. So, again, while in this particular case the initial screening was done, it was recognized during the proposed plan and ROD process that this was an issue. You know, as you start getting into things in more detail in the remedial design, and, you know, in this particular case, the scope of the design started changing some. The significance of those cultural artifacts and the locations that are of concern, they became more and more relevant as the action changed or evolved. So, again, it's critical to be aware of, you know, what's going on and the potentials for your site. Now, obviously, if we knew where the footprint of the design was going to be exactly at the time of the proposed pan and the ROD, we might have been able to avoid some of the delays, but, you know, again, that did not occur. So, you know, again, the awareness, the early identification is really critical. Now, go back to these slides were prepared by an RPM for the site, and, you know, trying to give his perspective on, you know, how to go about the identification determination process and what his expectations are. And, you know, up front, again, as I said, you know, the concept being right now is, in most cases, the AR analysis is often included as part of the feasibility study. And then the RPM will go in and use those AR tables as a starting point to develop the ARs for the ROD. again, the earlier that can be done, the better off everyone's going to be. Obviously, for certain AORs, the feasibility study is going to be too late. Going to the next slide, looking at where you feel, where the regional council, where the site attorney sit in. And, you know, at that point, once the RPM gets that early draft of the AORs table, they'll start going over that with the attorney, or as early as possible, to get the review process of the specific AORs started. And at that point, the state counterpart to the RPM will be formally contacted and request that, you know, identify the AORs from the state. Now, again, you know, this whole process should be going a little bit earlier, you know, as early as possible, and everybody should be thinking of the AORs and identifying them as soon as possible. To recap this particular case study, the selected AORs here ended up being, as they always are, critical, but things like the wetland issues, the historic preservation issues, are having a significant impact on the RD process and the overall things, the overall process of the site and the time frames. So it's key that these things be identified early and things move on. Both the contractor, the site attorneys, the in-house tech support, such as myself, that we're involved in the process. We help out where we can to identify the AORs and to make sure that they get updated as necessary. Things like the endangered species identification. Going to slide 52. Again, to go a little further on the role of regional tech support and specialists within the contractors or other, you know, state agencies, again, those individuals with specific expertise can provide input in their area of expertise to help the process move a little bit further, a little bit easier. So with that, moving to slide 53, and then we'll, if there are any questions at this point, I think we can afford to take a quick break, let myself get my voice back, and see if there's any general questions at this point. Easy questions, preferably.
Okay. For those of you who are on the telephone lines, you are welcome to take yourself off of mute. If you've muted your lines, you can hit #6. We do ask if you're on the phone lines to identify yourself at least by either your name or organization, and then feel free to ask your question out loud. We've heard somebody on the phone line. Go ahead.
Yep, this is Amy Rosenstein. I'm a consultant. I have a question on the format that you showed on slides 34, 35, and 36. In your opinion, does that format provide enough specific detail? I know you mentioned that you prefer having specific details rather than the generic listing of AORs. So I wanted to find out if that is, I know it's not a required format, but is that a preferred format that you showed there?
That is an example format. How's that? I think it's a good start personally. I think it's important to coordinate with your RPM and work with them to determine what format is most appropriate for your site and what's going to be most helpful. Again, as I noted, that some folks believe that an even more detailed citation is most appropriate, but my concern there personally would be that as you get more detailed without the appropriate expertise, you may miss something else. So I think at least for the initial determination of potential AORs, getting into this level of detail provides a very good starting point. And I believe we have some RPMs on the line. I'd be kind of curious as to their perspective on things, particularly since we have a number of different regions represented.
Okay.
So you guys care to weigh in on that. But again, I think ultimately talk with whoever you're working for to make sure it's making them happy. But I think this is a good starting point. I think David, the attorney that provided these, provided them because he did think they are a good point to start. So, you know, I don't, that is an assumption on my part. Hope that helps.
Excellent. If those of you who are streaming the audio online, you are welcome to continue typing up comments or questions using the question mark button that appears at the top of your slides. You can type up those comments in the new window that will open up, and I'll read them out loud. I do have a few that have come in, but before we switch over to those, is there anyone else on the phone line who has a question or comment at this point? Again, #6 to unmute your line and identify yourself.
This is Simeon Hahn, and I'll be presenting in a little bit, but I guess I'll couch this as a question slash comment, and that is related to the term support agency. And I think commonly people obviously recognize their state lead cleanup agency as a support agency. But I forwarded this question within NOAA, I'm not a lawyer, so this is just the information I'm getting back. But the information I got back is that we are a support agency, and it makes sense to us in some ways in that we get letters inviting us to participate in the process early, even from site assessment stage, remedial investigation type stage. And you know, some of that's done for our NRDA trustee responsibilities, but I think if some of the AWARs that I'll be talking about are to be identified early, it's certainly within it's probably our responsibility and, you know, our part of our partnership with EPA to identify those AWARs early on. So I would just advocate, especially for location-specific AWARs, that the support agencies shouldn't be just considered as your state RPM colleague.
And I think it's, honestly, in the context of these slides, I've never particularly asked how the phrase support agency means and what that goes back to, if it's specifically going back to the relationship between EPA and the state as a support agency, or if it's more inclusive. But I think the point Simeon makes is critical, because Endangered Species Act is probably one of the best examples where people on a day-by-day basis understand and recognize that they must do those initial consultations to identify whether or not an endangered species is potentially going to be impacted or occur within the site area. So that consultation practice, that automatically occurs, or should automatically occur, and it should occur on a routine basis throughout the life of the project. Unfortunately, I don't think that necessarily happens on a lot of the other, in a lot of the other regulatory realm and some of the other ARRs where they are, as Simeon said, location specific. So I think it's something to keep in mind. And, you know, I guess to a degree, even if it's just the point of making sure you have the documentation that you did in fact consider this, I think wherever one of these other, one of these ARRs that we're going to be discussing, where there is the potential that it's going to be applicable to your site, it's not going to hurt to have the documentation that you checked. And I think it's a good method to ensure that you do that. And, you know, this is a subject I'm going to touch on in about 2 seconds, but this is where, especially when it comes to NOAA and Fish and Wildlife and even some of the other agencies, when these agencies have individuals sitting in on groups like the Biological Technical Assistance Group, the role of those folks should in fact be to help address these particular ARRs, to identify them early on. And their role is a liaison between the agencies. It's key that, you know, we've got a great resource, and, you know, from EPA's perspective, you know, we tap them. We need to tap them, and we should tap them. So.
Okay, great. I'm going to take the one question that's come in online before we go back to the presentation. And this is coming in from PAYDEP, which is Pennsylvania's Department, I believe, of Environmental Protection in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And they're asking in reference to slide number 11, how are, quote, on-site and off-site defined?
Well, I will take it from a strictly my understanding of the definition within CERCLA, on-site being anything within the boundaries of the site as determined by the presence of contamination. That's the way that I would look at it. And I would look at off-site as everything that is not the site. Now, whether or not within the citation, whether or not that is accurate, I think you would need to consult with the RPM and the site attorney on a specific basis. Kind of a cop-out, but that's the way I look at it. I hope that helps.
Okay, great. I think at this point we can safely return back to the presentation. So we'll have everyone refer to slide number 54.
54. And again, basically what I'm going to do now is just present my perspective, you know, again, my world of influence as a BTAG coordinator and, for lack of a better word, my sales pitch as to what BTAGs can do for you, kind of thing. Slide 55. And again, as I alluded to, before, the specific technical support resources that are available to folks can provide a lot of timely input in identifying ARARs right from the start, early in the process. We, as BTAG, Biological Technical Assistance Group, we often focus, as I said earlier, on the chemical-specific ARARs, things like ambient water quality criteria, risk-based cleanup numbers, that kind of thing. Often, the BTAGs are going to have a lot of resources to be able to provide information on location-specific ARARs. Slide 56, you know, most of the location-specific ARARs, when you think about it, or maybe it's just the way I think about it, but most of them do, in fact, relate to the protection of biological resources. Slide 57. The BTAGs are in very unique positions to be able to help in this process. Our members generally include, as I indicated, other federal agencies, in our case, NOAA, Fish and Wildlife. Sometimes the state agencies are formal members of the BTAG. Other times they're kind of consulting members. In this, an example for us, where we've had a very close relationship with Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, just due to the nature of our sites and the common interest concerns that we face. So, you know, we've got folks on the ground that are dealing with these on a very hands-on way, right from the start, and they're involved in the projects right from the start. And even beyond the individuals within the groups, often just the nature of the groups and the breadth of folks that we need to deal with as part of our day-to-day activities, we've got a very vast network of folks that are often tied into other ARARs, whether it be other state agencies, different local experts, both in the private sector and in academia. It provides a pretty wide network. So, you know, you might look at from, you know, one RPM can contact his, you know, BTAG, and all of a sudden that network of support, you know, branches out. In some cases, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 people very rapidly. So, you know, the BTAGs represent a very good point of contact for ecologically related information. And in a lot of cases, the information ends up spilling over beyond just the biological and ecological errors. Slide 58, again, you know, the need, the stressing of identifying each other in a timely manner. Again, since we have folks from other, lack of a better word, key agencies that are responsible for a lot of these errors, the BTAS can provide that that notice, that timely notification, and can help facilitate navigating your way through the AOR process. Slide 59. Again, as I noted, most of the biological resources, location-specific AORs, in fact, you know, tied to our day-to-day kind of work. When you look at location-specific AORs and start to consider, you know, do I have a wetland? Am I in a floodplain? Those kind of things are critical to identifying, you know, what your site setting is and identifying habitats that are on site and what your ecological receptors are going to be that could potentially be impacted by site contaminants and that need to be addressed in the ecological risk assessment. So at this point, the AOR question in a general sense, but specifically, you know, the habitats that are being protected by those AORs tie directly into the whole discussion. Slide 60, again, you know, the specific locations that are protected, you know, include wilderness areas, wildlife refuges, scenic rivers, wetlands, floodplains. You know, you can go on with those things, but, you know, I think you guys get the general idea that, you know, we're tied into these location-specific AORs. I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is when it comes into the details of the AORs and what's being protected, you know, things that we can help out with and some of the day-to-day practical implications of those AORs is, you know, how does the site work going to impact or be impacted by the AOR, by the presence of an endangered species or breeding habitat of an endangered species. And, you know, things that we can help consider right up front are things like how do you work around some of the concerns? You know, can you do the remedial action but have to limit yourself temporally? For example, if you're doing a river cleanup in an area where it's a salmon or a shad migration or something like that, the mitigation may simply be to avoid the remedial action during the migration season. So, you know, while in some cases some of the burdens may seem to be pretty ominous, practically it may not be that that burdensome. Slide 62. This in the next few slides, I just want to give you a general idea of the kinds of specific ecologically related AORs that you're going to come in contact with or that you can come in contact with, that again, people or the ecological risk assessors are going to be in tune with. Slide 63 starts going into some additional examples, starting to go into some things that folks might not necessarily routinely consider. We all know Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act for wetlands, but we don't often think of things like Coastal Zone Management Acts and Floodplain Management Acts and those kind of things. Slide 64, these are just some of the examples of some state AORs that are out there, just to give you an idea of the breadth of specific state AORs that are out there that you may not normally think about. So it's really important to make sure you have good communication with your state representatives to ensure that these AORs are, in fact, being addressed. And, you know, in addition at the RPM and the state level, to the degree that your ecological risk assessors have contact with state counterparts or state resource specialists, you'll do yourself a favor in terms of trying to identify a wider breadth right from the start so you don't miss anything. Slide 65, again, provides some additional examples of state-related, state ecological type ARARs. And again, while I think the focus from an ecological perspective, from a VTAG coordinator's perspective, tends to be a lot on the location-specific ARARs, it's easy to lose sight that the typical focus, and in my case, I just don't think about it. You know, kind of automatically do it, but, you know, it's the chemical-specific ARARs that are also obviously extremely key because they set cleanup standards. Again, those ARARs can be based on risk to ecological receptors, whether it's state water quality criteria or state standards. Again, in this particular slide, you know, whether or not TMDLs are ARARs or TBCs, I won't necessarily go that way. Question of, that's arisen, are state screening values ARARs? And the answer to that typically is going to be no, because they're not uniformly enforced and they're not an ARAR per se. They are a screening value. Now, that may vary because some states, they've taken their screening values and gone through the process and adopted them into specific standards, such as Washington Sediment Management Standards. Again, it's important to consider things like site-specific standards or state water quality criteria, you know, which are going to be AOR and which are TBCs. So that whole discussion creeps up. A good resource that was pointed out to me is identified on slide 67, and this is Oak Ridge National Labs. Look for federal water quality criteria, and it does have some information on state ARRs in the states that they are operating. Turn to slide 68, and you get an idea of what you can select from, and it'll give you output in a tabular manner. So it's a nice little resource. So with that, I'll touch very quickly on Clean Water Act. And then we'll kick it over to Simeon. I guess the main thing with the Clean Water, and I'll touch on NEPA as well, just a little bit, because sometimes it comes up. If you turn to slide 70, it's often forgotten that the National Environmental Policy Act is, in fact, an ARR and, you know, has to be considered. Now, in Superfund, the entire RIFS process is considered a functional equivalent of NEPA. So I think that's why most people don't think about it too much. But again, I think it's kind of important to keep that concept in mind. Moving on to slide 71 and the Clean Water Act, specifically as it relates to Section 404 and basically wetlands. It's important to keep in mind, I think, that the 404 isn't limited to wetlands per se as defined by the Corps or limited by the Corps, what we think of in that realm. It regulates discharge into all sorts of navigable waters. And, you know, it's important to keep that in mind because you may start getting yourself stovepiped to think that, you know, you got to have squishy dirt and be able to walk in it for it to be a wetland that you're going to be considering. But Clean Water Act really goes beyond that. Slide 72. And I think most folks are familiar with the concept of 404 and avoiding avoidance and mitigation and all that fun stuff. And again, with the basic idea being ultimately a goal of no net loss. the Corps of Engineers on slide 73. The Corps of Engineers delineation manual is obviously used to determine whether or not you have a wetland on site. Slide 74, again, basics. That takes three elements to determine whether or not you have a wetland per se. But I think the important thing to keep in mind, especially, you know, since this is a national and in some cases international audience, it's important to keep in mind that your traditional view of a wetland may not, in fact, be broad enough to include what a wetland is. This time of year in the Mid-Atlantic and in the Northeast, you know, the prevalence of vernal pools is noticeable, whether it be through the fact that areas that you used to go in wandering on a hike are now inundated, or the chorus of frogs that you're hearing out there now. So those things, if you go to them in the summer, you're not typically going to associate them with a wetland, but they are. So, you know, make sure you keep those kind of things in mind when you're making these broad considerations. Slide 75, a little reminder, the importance of why it's important to protect wetlands, which hopefully everybody knows and appreciates. Slide 76, again, don't forget the streams. It's the same kind of approach, same kind of considerations. Slide 77, now this is, I think, important to point out special aquatic sites under the Clean Water Act, where they may or may not be overlooked. Personally, I have a tendency to think that they are overlooked, but if you know you're going to have them, think twice about how, you know, special measures to try protecting these kind of resources and doing what you can to ensure their protection. So those are identified on slide 77. Slide 78, again, the importance of mitigation, making sure you're replacing the functions and the values of a resource or its potential function. Slide 79 discusses mitigation specifically in terms of, you know, the different approaches and essentially, you know, the steps and how different people view it. You know, whether or not it's in kind, out of kind, on or off site, whether or not you're restoring a wetland, creating a new one or enhancing an existing one. Depending on where you're located and the different agencies that you're working with, there has a tendency to be a preference towards different types of mitigation and what is acceptable in your particular area. So, now you may be an RPM that's dealing across a region. In one particular area of your region, it may be perfectly acceptable to do an in-kind mitigation off-site. In another area of your region, it may be the preference to buy into a mitigation bank. So you have to be aware of these kind of things. There are different mitigation ratios that can be applied that vary from state to state. Even I've seen from core region to core region. Go ahead. I'm sorry, that's slide 80. Thank you, Simeon. And this gives you an example of, you know, some of the ratios that we have seen. Slide 81, this is kind of something that's important to identify. It ends up not particularly an AOR, but it's critical to the success of making sure you ultimately achieve the AOR, and that's making sure whatever form you do a mitigation for a wetland to make sure that the thing is going to be a success. So if you end up getting a failure of your wetland 2 years after it's built and after, you know, you close out your site and then you go to a five-year review and you no longer have a functioning wetland, are you still in compliance with that AOR? I'm going to tend to think not, but I'll defer to the attorneys for that one. So with that, go to slide 82, and I think we could break a couple minutes for questions if there's anything else to wrap those up, and then I'm going to turn it over to Simeon to address some of the specific NOAA and Fish and Wildlife concerns.
So, again, if you're streaming audio, you can go ahead and type up a comment or question now. We'll read them off. We can get some submitted now. If not, we'll certainly, you can type them up now, and we'll hold them until we have another break, and we'll address them, worst case scenario, at the end of the presentation. I don't see any that were submitted online right now, but go ahead. You can continue to type those up if you need to. For those of you on the phone lines, though, please feel free to take yourself off of mute. Hit #6 so that you can identify yourself and ask your question. Okay, I don't hear any questions coming in on the phone line, so it sounds like, Bruce, you've done a fine job explaining everything.
Well, I put everyone to sleep.
No, they're there. Don't worry. So I think with that, what I'll do is, again, continue, everyone. If you started to type up a comment or question, you continue to do that. We will save all of those in the queue until our next break for questions and answers. Same thing, we'll take another break to deal with phone line questions in a bit. And I'll just direct everyone to move along to slide number 83 so you can carry on with the presentation.
Okay, and I'll turn it over to Simeon now.
Okay, the title of consulting with NMFS, which stands for National Marine Fisheries Service, which is a part of NOAA. The folks that routinely work on BTAGs, certainly in Region 3, are not part of National Marine Fisheries Service, but work for the National Ocean Service under NOAA. So just wanted to make that distinction. They're really, and this moves over from the Clean Water Act, which Bruce just described, focusing on one of the services that these habitats provide, and that is fish habitat. And there's two key mandates identified on slide 84. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, which designates essential fish habitat provisions, and the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. Moving to 85, slide 85. Magnuson-Stevens Act is from 1996, and it is the law that governs the management and conservation of federal fisheries, including provisions to protect and conserve the habitat of those fisheries. So a lot of the CERCLA, AROR-type guidance documents, this was a point I remember the EPA attorney making, so when those guidance documents and such were emphasized, the Magnuson-Stevens Act hadn't even been passed. So I think often I'll see the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, which was from 1970-something, but not the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which actually is probably more important, or could be considered more important, especially related to fish habitat. Slide number 86 gives some quotations there from the Act. Again, but it's to protect essential fish habitat. And we'll move to 87. Another definition from the Act is the waters and substrate necessary to fish for spawning, breeding, feeding, or growth to maturity. Slide number 88 gives some information. There's the fishery management plans. These are for commercial fisheries, the essential fish habitat. And so in the fishery management plans, they have to identify and describe the essential fish habitat for each federally managed species. The figure you see there is for winter flounder, and it clearly shows how essential fish habitat also includes state waters. In this particular figure, you can see the entire Delaware Bay, Delaware Estuary, is essential fish habitat for winter flounder. There is an online tool, moving to slide 89, for which it provides maps of essential fish habitat. I am not that familiar with the tool, but I would imagine, and we can certainly facilitate anybody going through this, that you can query by a particular area or water body location to find the essential fish habitat. I know you can certainly do it by species. Slide number 90. The adverse effects are defined as impact that reduces the quantity or quality of essential fish habitat. and can include both direct and indirect physical, chemical, or biological alterations. Moving on to slide 91. Under the Magnuson Act, each federal agency has to evaluate whether the proposed action may adversely affect essential fish habitat and prepare a written essential fish habitat assessment of any action that requires a consultation. We certainly know, and the BTAG reps that Bruce talked about and others can help in, you know, scoping out what exactly this EFH assessment would be, probably identifying what species, where the essential fish habitat is, and what the potential sources of stress on that habitat are, to identify, you know, any actions that could adversely affect those habitats. Number 92. After the assessment is made, the National Marine Fisheries Service will provide conservation recommendations, which can include alternatives to the project, recommendations to mitigate or to minimize impacts. So basically recommendations which protect that essential fish habitat. It doesn't necessarily say that an action can't be taken in that habitat. That's something that was very clearly made. With the Magnuson-Stevens Act does not give the authority for NOAA to veto, if you will, a project, certainly a CERCLA project, but it does require that consultation and consideration of those recommendations. The last bullet says if those recommendations aren't accepted, there should be some reasonable explanation as to why. So in here, you're not even necessarily waiving the AROR, you're addressing the AROR. You may not be able to address every one of those recommendations even, and there may not be, an alternative that would minimize those. But, you know, you've complied with that AROR by going through the assessment and consultation process. Slide number 93 is an important point that I was going to make. And for folks familiar with NEPA, and perhaps folks that work with the Clean Water Act or the Office of Water and EPA, know that there's these things called JPAs, or Joint Permit Agencies. So basically, they are a committee of different groups that administer or oversee or have the authority for particular environmental regulations that may relate to projects, certainly aquatic projects. And what we often recommend, and I know in particular of some DOD sites that have taken this recommendation, is they go to the JPA, request to get on their ballot or on their agenda, and then just give an overview of their project early on. They can come back numerous times, and then they generally are the agencies are well represented. So, you know, under the Clean Water Act, for example, people from NOAA might be at that meeting as a review agency under the Clean Water Act. But even if they're not, someone familiar with the Clean Water Act that works with it a lot would say, well, you may want to also check with NOAA about essential fish habitat. So you can streamline these processes by going through different environmental regulatory review processes that already exist. Slide 94 is moving on to the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. Again, this is an older act. And it's more general, that applies to all fish habitat, not just commercially managed species. And federal agencies are required to consult with National Marine Fisheries Service on impacts to fish habitat. There also are coordination requirements for the Fish and Wildlife Service for other resources than fish. as the bullet has said there, the process is less specific and does not require a federal agency response even to that initial coordination if you get a letter back with recommendations. Technically, you don't even have to give a federal agency response, but hopefully those recommendations are considered and incorporated where they can be, and you can certainly document compliance with this AWR by going through that process. Slide number 95, our additional resources from the National Marine Fisheries Services, National Marine Fisheries Service on essential fish habitat, and there's the website for the EFH mapper, and there's some other fact sheets and such, so additional resources for those. Moving on to slide 96, the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Besides my work in Superfund, I got a very good on-hands experience with these provisions in my role during the deepwater spill. I was the technical lead for the damage assessment for impacts to marine mammals and sea turtles. So all sea turtles in the Gulf are endangered species, and all the mammals we were dealing with, some of them were endangered species. They're also covered under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And I can tell you firsthand from my experience that even though it's my agency and in a national crisis, it was viewed as one like the deepwater spill, that complying and going through the process of complying with these regulations is something to take very seriously. Even in this particular example, we weren't able to do necessarily all the field work, injury assessment type work that were being recommended by various groups and certainly the Natural Resource Trustees because these acts required particular consultation and a public comment in some period and in some instances. So, you know, we weren't able to ourselves even waive these requirements. Moving on to slide 97. This is just some general. I'm going to run through these pretty quick, but I think people understand what the Endangered Species Act, why it was developed in 73, and that's to decrease the amount of extinction of species, certainly by man-made, for man-made reasons. Slide number 98, it protects not just the species, but also their ecosystems. All federal departments and agencies shall seek to conserve endangered and threatened species. Slide number 99 discusses some of the prohibited acts under the Endangered Species Act. It's not limited to just killing them and selling them or exporting them out of the U.S., out of the United States. Takes are pretty liberally defined, including harassment. So I think this is an example where Bruce said, technically, even before remedial investigation activities, certainly intrusive ones, where you're making a lot of noise or banging down trees and such like that, you should consult with the agencies, both NOAA for NOAA-listed species and the Fish and Wildlife Service for listed species, and I have a figure that will show that, and get their recommendations and do that consultation so you're not taking endangered species. Again, that can be, the term harass is very liberally applied, but certainly noise, destruction of habitat, those type of things that would all be considered takes. Hopefully, no RPMs are in the business of selling or offering for sale any endangered species, but that is illegal. On slide number 100, there's some specific prohibitions for plants, which are listed here, and very similar to
what applies for animals listed, although I guess the definition of harassment would be a little bit different. Slide number 101. I think I'm it's similar to what Bruce says. I don't want to read all these specific sections of the Endangered Species Act because I think in practicality it takes some interpretation from people that work as experts in this field. And, you know, even by reading them may offer more questions in people's minds. And so it really comes down to the specific consultation. But again, all federal agencies, even though they are required, you know, to comply and promote the provisions of the Endangered Species Act. Slide number 102. There's applications for non-federal entities. I don't think this may pertain to us, or federal actions where exceptions from the prohibitions of take occur. And there in slide 103, again, this probably doesn't apply to Superfund, although it can. And actually, for the oil spill, it did. And these are section 10. So if you want to do research on an endangered species, or somehow, you know, look at the effects of a particular contaminant on an endangered species, or monitor the impact of the remedial action, then you may need to get consultation regarding Section 10, which is scientific purposes. We, in the Gulf spill, were actually directed that we had to follow the Section 10 route versus the Section 7 route, which kind of slowed down our process somewhat. So slide number 104. It's kind of a summary. Fish and Wildlife Service, generally the consultant agency for terrestrial and freshwater species. There also are state Endangered Species Act type of laws. And here's this example of coppers with a state-listed plant, as it was a good example. The National Marine Fisheries Service is the consultant agency for anadromous and marine species. Anadromous meaning resources which primarily fish that live in saltwater environments but come in and use freshwater environments for spawning in early life stages. If as part of the consultation process, you may be, the EPA may be required, or the lead agency, to prepare a biological assessment, which basically describes the property, the site, identifies that you know, where it was determined that there was endangered species were present on site or habitat. And provides information on what the activities would have on the listed species. It's recommended highly as part of this consultation process that, you know, there's more verbal dialogue meetings before that biological assessment is actually submitted to the agency for review. The outcome of that is that the trustees will issue a biological opinion or occurrence letter that contains an assessment of the impacts of the, on the threatened and endangered species. This also, you know, the consultation time frames, you can see that, but the formal process, you know, getting into the biological opinion and such, you know, 135 days. So again, another warning to start the process early. The Marine Mammal Protection Act, 1972, again, an older one that's probably was addressed in some of the AROR's guidance documents. as the name implies, addresses marine mammals. There's some bullets here about the findings in the policy. Basically, the law was was designated to protect these animals, which were many on the danger of extinction, and several are on the endangered species list to this day. Similar type of definitions on the term taking, harassment, being one that, you know, capture people's attention. I think most people would know killing, attempting to hunt, and those type of things. It's not limited to those type of actions. There are some permitted exceptions that are listed there. There's also some incidental take on slide 107, allowed for marine mammals. A lot of that may have to do with, boat type of traffic or work in, actions which would be probably more related to harass. But, you know, there are instances where animals takes have to be designated. Once those limits are reached, then the agencies have to revisit and look at maybe providing some alternative recommendations or raise the take limit. Slide 108. Again, they give some specific measures that can be taken to try to avoid the unmitigable adverse impacts. Generally require some type of monitoring and reporting. Slide 109. Describes some of the authorizations under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. A letter of authorization or an incidental harassment authorization. Again, I think these are best, discussion on those are probably best, you can read them, but they're probably best reserved for specific consultation or negotiation with NOAA or Fish and Wildlife Service on that. Slide 110, there's some additional resources for information, including Section 7 for the Fish and Wildlife Service and for NOAA. So with that, we're at slide number 111 in the National Historic Preservation Act.
And that means that Bruce is back on the line to say that, similar to these other ones, we're not going to go into much detail with these. Historic Preservation Act is definitely not my specialty, but this year's NARPM will go into this in much more detail, but I thought it was important, just obviously due to the nature of this particular AOR, that I provide these slides in these sessions for you to have at your disposal so you can become a little bit more familiar with them and have it as a resource. So if you've never had to deal with it before, hopefully this will open your eyes a little bit to realize that, you know, it's something that you have to be considering and maybe provide you with some additional information that you can do a little additional research if you need to. You turn to slide 112. There's a little background on the nature of the Historic Preservation Act, why it was enacted, and, you know, the breadth of the statute a little bit. I think as it comes out and going into slide 113 in part, I think it's important, again, to stress that the nature of the early screening, to make sure you're identifying potential areas of interest of the Preservation Act, to identify them early on so that you can make sure all of the appropriate agencies at both the federal, state, and tribal level are contacted as necessary, because there is a level of review and approval that's going to be necessary. Now, the Department of Interior, they are responsible for the guidelines for some of the federal agency responsibilities. They review and approve the state and tribal historic preservation programs. So, again, if nothing else, when it comes down to coordination by going to the contacts within Department of Interior, they can help identify the more relevant contacts at the state and local level to make sure that you're addressing the issue in a proper manner and contacting the right people. Moving on to slide 114. The Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, they are responsible for promulgating regulations, implementing federal agency obligations. So, again, they're another key group to engage as necessary. Moving on to slide 115, it gives you an idea of the breadth, the scope of Historic Preservation Act and the kinds of things that you're going to be looking at and being concerned about. I think some of the, I'll turn to the Delaware site again. The significance of that site wasn't anything that most people would necessarily recognize, as it was a prehistoric type site. So the kind of things that they were finding were, to a non-anthropologist or archaeologist, I found them pretty fascinating and pretty interesting. But in terms of trying to identify that kind of thing, you need the experts. You need the specialists to be able to tap into. And again, a lot of that occurs at the state and local level. So it's important to do that coordination. Slide 116 goes into a little bit more detail on the nature of federal undertakings. Slide 117 talks about relevant obligations. And again, bottom line is to consider the effects of the takings on the historic properties, to provide a reasonable opportunity for the appropriate agencies to comment, and to, you know, make sure you're implementing the appropriate actions to ensure that there's not going to be an impact, or to minimize the impact on these areas. And slide 18 generally addresses the, I apologize there, I went and lost my spot. Slide 18 talks about the procedural steps on how to go through the actions and to make the appropriate identification and resolving any kind of effects that may occur. The last step is kind of interesting to know. I was, again, going back to the Coppers example, talking about the consultation process and how that has impacted the remedial design and essentially stalled some of the activities for about a year and a half at this point in some cases. But right now we are currently in the process of developing and negotiating, signing the memorandum of agreement for that. So, you know, again, for my theme, you know, early identification to try keeping projects on track and keep them moving. I'm sure on slide 119, folks that are familiar with dealing with tribal lands or in regions with tribal lands, I think you guys are more familiar with it than we are in Region 3. We do not have tribal lands federally recognized within our region. However, there are areas of cultural interest such as the Delaware site. So I'm not going to pretend to even be able to do much in the way of consultation for you. You guys know this stuff better than I do. You also know that there are experts within your regions, within EPA, and then state and within the tribal settings, you know, individuals that, you know, this is their specialty. So, again, make sure you tap the resources that you need as early as possible to making sure that you can preserve these kind of sites and or do the necessary mitigation and keep projects moving. And, again, preservation, you know, in a lot of these cases is key, I think. And finally, moving on to slide 120. And ultimately, you know, it's important to keep in mind resources like CERCLA compliance with other laws and manuals, that'll address some of the specific questions that you might have. In particular, it does address National Historic Preservation Act. It identifies it as an AOR, treats it as an AOR, and it provides processes for, you know, addressing some of the activities and what needs to happen. So, you know, here's just one more resource that you can go to for more information as it applies to your site. The final slide on this particular topic talks about emergency situations, and again, if you happen to have that, again, it's something to keep in mind and specific citation on how to deal with it. Again, within each of your regions and in our region, there are experts to consult to help you address this particular AOR. So I strongly suggest early contact with those individuals to keep things going and to do what you need to do. Finally, our last topic, I'll turn it back over to Simeon.
Okay. So, yeah, these are the slide 122, consideration of fish and wildlife resources during project planning. This was presentation given by the Fish and Wildlife Service at last year's NORPM. There's considerable overlap with in the presentations regarding the Endangered Species Act, so I'm going to go through that. And for those attending NORPM this year, we are working and we'll consolidate that presentation. I think the specific ones that we haven't talked about yet are the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Bald Eagle Protection Act, those two. The first bullet there under objectives, protection of fish and wildlife sources relevant to pesticide application, I think that's generally under FIFRA. There could potentially be a link to Superfund, certainly if pesticides are used illegally. But I think we're really the two we haven't talked about that need attention are Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Bald Eagle Protection Act. Slide number 124 gives a website address, again, for more information on these. Under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act on number 125, there are tremendous number of birds that are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. There are a few species that have been introduced that are not covered. Again, provides protection for migratory birds, their nests, and eggs. Slide number 126. This is a pretty significant act. I used to work for the Department of Defense, Department of the Navy, and I know of one particular instance where a commanding officer was actually put in jail for violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Now, granted, this got to the point where he was told not to mess with this osprey nest, and he willfully did it. So it, yeah. You know, that was a kind of an extreme example, but I am not an expert on the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. I just know it covers a lot of, if you have any type of habitat at your site, you probably have some migratory birds, so, that use that site for habitat. So again, getting some consultation, and usually, you know, that can be initiated through the BTAG, as Bruce mentioned, to try to minimize, takes impacts, to migratory birds. Slide number 127, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. In the past, both those species were probably more rigorously addressed under the Endangered Species Act, but particularly the bald eagle has been downgraded, and I think it's no longer endangered. I think it's still threatened. So there are, you know, it's a lower category, but it even has its own specific protection under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. Slide number 128. If necessary, I guess provisions allow for authorization of two types of take permits. Again, I think in most instances, the minimization and mitigative actions, certainly minimization or avoidance actions can be given to not even get you into that type of category. And 129 begins discussion of further information on the Endangered Species Act, which I will go through in the interest of leaving the last 5 minutes for some questions and wrap up. But slide number 138, if we can move to that. Again, I think this is the take-home message. Early identification and coordination is the take-home message here.
There will be a test on that.
I guess the one last point, too, in looking at slide 139, is that, in general, because Superfund is a project that has the protection of the environment and protection of human health risk as its objective, that where necessary, you know, that these type of provisions will not keep you from taking an action at a site. You know, there is a recognized need where there is certainly, you know, uncontrolled releases and unexpected, the action needs to be taken. And sometimes, you know, there's consequences for everyone involved in that action. So it shouldn't be looked at as something that's going to stop your project. And now it could be if this coordination is not done early and could put significant delays on the project. But I think the, you know, for the us gamblers out there, you know, you can roll the dice and get away with it, but if it catches up to your project, you're going to spend much more time than it probably would have required from an early coordination perspective.
And I'll give you know, another specific example of that, something that's relatively routinely encountered. When you are doing some of the early surveys, say, you know, for endangered species, for example, a lot of the species are only evident seasonally. So, say for example, you have to do a survey when the species are out there and present in the breeding season. The breeding season only lasts 2 or 3 weeks. If you happen to miss that window because you did not do your early planning and your early identification, that can literally throw off a project for a year. So if you delay that initial coordination, the initial identification, until the last minute, until, oh, it's, you know, I'm doing it in the proposed plan stage, I got a few months before the rod, if there's an issue, I'll identify it. Well, you may end up setting the rod back, and it could have a pretty significant impact. So, you know, again, there's a specific example where, you know, where we have seen the lack of consideration have impacts on project schedules. So something to be aware of. With that, before I'm going to steal Gene's thunder for a second, before we do hang up, I would like to thank everybody, and hopefully the information that we presented is of some use to you. All joking aside, I think our messages were fairly clear, and hopefully you know, we've acquainted you with some information on some AORs that you may not be familiar with. To the few folks that I've seen in Missouri and Tennessee, I know you don't have much interest in NOAA.
Not yet. The global warming's coming.
Yeah. In all seriousness, the messages are still relevant across the board. So, Jean, all yours.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we are coming up on the scheduled end time, but because we started just a few minutes late, I'm going to ask everyone if we can hang tight for about 3 or 4 more minutes, and we'll spend some time answering a couple of questions. I do have a few that were submitted electronically, but before I turn over to those, I'm going to give the participants by phone, if you have any questions or comments you'd like to squeeze in, please be sure to unmute your phone line. You can hit #6 and then identify yourself to make your question or ask, or to make a comment or ask a question. Okay, well, with that, the next question that I do have submitted online is coming in from the EPA. And they ask, does the Magnuson-Stevens Act apply to freshwater resources, for example, the Great Lakes and rivers, or is there an equivalent freshwater act?
Okay, the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act covers all fish habitat. So, as I mentioned, that's a more general type of provision. The Magnuson can include fresh waters. It is only for commercially managed species. The Great Lakes is a question that I should know, but I don't. But I believe that commercial species managed, that there are commercial species in the Great Lakes that are managed under Magnuson because of St. Lawrence Seaway and such. But it does, it's dependent on the species and its life history. It can include freshwater habitats, but it's limited to commercially managed species.
Okay, great. The next question is really more of a comment, and it's in reference to a slide that I think was somewhere in the 90s. I may be misnumbered here, though. This is coming in from Walnut Creek, California. And they state that the link to the mapper does not work. It is http://www.habitat.noaa.gov/protection/ehf/habitatmapper.html. It appears that they just launched version 2, and this link will take you to it.
Thank you very much. That was last year's slide, so what you just gave was the correct link.
And we can certainly, we can update the resources page to include the updated link as well when we're done with today's session.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. I don't see any other comments or questions coming in online. So, again, just one final call for the phone participants. Again, #6 to unmute to ask a question. Okay, and just we'll go back very quickly to Bruce and see if you have any closing statements or comments you'd like to make before I formally close things out today.
Nothing else. I'd like to thank everybody for your time. Hopefully you found it useful. Jean, thank you very much for your help with this.
Excellent. Thank you. And how about Simeon? Do you have any closing statements?
No, just thank you very much, and that's it.
Okay, great. So with that, I'm going to direct everybody to the final slide, which is slide number 140. And on that slide, you'll find two links. The first one is a link to the additional resources page, where you'll be able to download not only today's presentation, but take a look at a few other items that were collected in reference to today's session. It's also where we'll post the updated link to that mapper as well. The other link that's important for those of you who are participating, especially if you're trying to get credit, is the feedback form link. If you click that link, it'll take you to a new page where you can actually fill out a feedback form. It takes about a minute to do. It's a very short form. I do read each and every single one of those responses, so if you found today's session informative and you'd like to continue to participate in free online training like this through Kluin, we would ask that you fill out that form and let us know what you thought of today's session. For those of you looking for confirmation of your participation, when you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check to have a confirmation message sent to you for your records that does verify that you participated and gave us feedback. While we don't offer CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN, occasionally the accrediting institutions will accept a copy of your registration email, a copy of the materials, and this type of a confirmation message to verify that you did participate. You may earn credit with that. If you shared the line with multiple participants, each individual person can actually take a turn to submit feedback. There'll be links that'll pop up once you fill out the form and submit it that the next person can click on a link and take their turn to fill out the form. And, of course, if you don't have time to fill it out or you have a printed copy in front of you, those links to the resources and as well as the feedback form can be found at the bottom of the seminar homepage. There are links that appear not only on the left side, there are buttons, but there are links at the very bottom, and those links will be active from this point forward, so you can certainly refer back to that as soon as you have a moment. So with that, I'll extend my thanks to our sponsors as well as both of our presenters today for putting on their material. I hope all of you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time, and that I'll either see you or hear from you at a future CLUIN seminar. With that, that will be the formal conclusion of today's session. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.